Well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to be here. Okay. The talk tonight is called Wittgenstein Changes His Mind, and on the handout there's a summary of the main dates in Wittgenstein's life. Parts 1, 2, and 3 of my lecture are about who Wittgenstein is, but I do want to add that I will only be saying little about who Wittgenstein is, and if you want to know more, there's a wonderful book by Ray Monk called Ludwig Wittgenstein, The Duty of Genius, and you'll find out much more about him there. Anyway, part one of my talk is about the idea of Wittgenstein as a responsive philosopher. At any rate, that's what he intends. When I call him a responsive philosopher, I mean a philosopher who sees thought as having gone significantly wrong and who responds to that going wrong of our thinking. Many philosophers have a strong responsive element in what they do as philosophers, but often they are also trying to establish something positive, like Hume, who wanted to do for the science of man what Newton had done for natural philosophy. So that's exactly what I'm not calling responsive philosophy. Thank you. I have several quotations in the handout on responsive philosophy. The first is from the Tractatus, where Wittgenstein says that his book deals with the problems of philosophy and shows that the way these problems get put rests on misunderstanding of the logic of our language. Quotation C from Wittgenstein comes from many years later. He says, "As I do philosophy, its entire task is to shape expression in such a way that certain worries disappear." Worries or disquietudes, you could say, in our thinking. Quotation D is from the physicist Heinrich Hertz. What Hertz said about the confused questions we ask, this is something that deeply influenced Wittgenstein. Hertz was responding to the way people asked, "What is force?" He wrote, "When these painful contradictions arising from our confused ways of thinking about force have been removed, the question, what is the nature of force, won't have been answered, but our minds, no longer tormented, will stop asking unjustified questions." As Hertz sees it, the problem is that the term force is involved in many different relations, and we can't see how they all hang together. We feel this obscurely and want it cleared up, but our unclear desire gets expressed in an unclear question about the nature of force. If we can remove the appearance of conflicting conceptions, the sense of there being a question at all will disappear. The two quotations from Wittgenstein and the quotation from Hertz express a conception of philosophy that was important for Wittgenstein throughout his life. One of his favorite examples is in the handout, from Augustine's Confessions. Augustine asks, "What is time? If no one asks me, I know, but if I want to explain it, I don't know." Augustine sees a puzzle because he knows that we measure time. But how can time be measured? When it is past, it isn't there to be measured, and future time is not yet here to be measured. And the present moment has no duration. So there doesn't seem to be anything we can measure. This is exactly the kind of thing Wittgenstein speaks of as a disquietude. And Berkeley might say that here we have raised dust and then complain that we cannot see. It is also the kind of thing Hertz describes. We have a painful sense of things not fitting together that expresses itself in the form of a question. The question, what is time? But we don't need any new information. We need to be able to see how things that we do know hang together. Part two is my next bit about who Wittgenstein is. Part two is called Wittgenstein Reads Russell. In 1908, Wittgenstein went to Manchester to study engineering. Almost right away, another student recommended Bertrand Russell's book, The Principles of Mathematics. This is an exciting book. It really communicates the excitement of discovery and the excitement of new problems and totally new kinds of approaches to philosophical problems. Wittgenstein was hooked right away. What then was so exciting? Russell had been carried away by recent developments in logic. He had seen that you could develop the new logic and use it to show that all mathematics follows from logic. This could have profound philosophical consequences. He believed that earlier philosophy of mathematics, and in particular Kant's account of mathematics, depended on the inadequacy of logic. So the new work in logic could show that Kant's approach to mathematics had rested on the backward state that logic had been in. This is not a minor side issue in Kant's philosophy, and the conclusions that Russell reached were not limited to philosophy of mathematics, but had consequences for lots of metaphysical questions as well. I have three passages in the handout. I'm not going to read all of them. I'll just read a little bit of one. The three passages, F, G, and H, are all conveying Russell's enthusiasm for what can be accomplished by logic for philosophy. He says, for example, that we can now expect a period as glorious for philosophy as that of ancient Greece. So anyway, it's a remarkable statement. Anyway, in 1908, Wittgenstein begins reading Russell on recent logical developments and their importance for philosophy. Plus, you have four other things I'll mention. First, there are still problems in the new logic, problems that Russell himself sets before his readers. I will mention one of them because Wittgenstein immediately set to work on it, and he went on thinking about it for years and years. This is the paradox that Russell discovered, which appeared to be a deep problem for the foundations of mathematics. I'm not going to go over it, but I have put it in the handout. In summary form, it's item I. The fact that there are problems in Russell's account made it especially interesting to Wittgenstein, as showing a field of exciting new philosophical endeavor where he might make some significant contribution. A second important and striking thing in Russell's book is a way of thinking about the role of logic in philosophy. Russell thought of logic as having two parts. This is brought out in quotation J in the handout. One part of logic investigates what propositions are and what forms they have. For example, the question, is it part of the logical form of all propositions that they have a subject and a predicate? This belongs to this, what Russell calls the first part of logic. The second part of logic, according to Russell, is symbolic logic, a system of general formal truths, truths of logic, and these truths will give the justification of any logical inference. Both parts of logic were central in what Russell himself was doing and what he understood as the great progress that logic had been making. Russell combines the two parts of logic in arguing about mathematics. For example, he argues that there are propositions that are genuinely relational, like 3 is the successor of 2. This certainly looks as if it says that these two numbers stand in a relation, the relation of one being the successor of the other. But is that the real logical form of such propositions? Russell argued that yes, such propositions really are relational. Their logical form is not subject-predicate. The kind of criticism of Kantian metaphysics that you get in Russell then rested on the development of both parts of logic, the actual symbolic logic and also the argument that there are genuinely relational propositions, which is an argument that comes from the first part of what Russell calls logic. Here we get an idea of philosophy as containing the logical investigation of propositions and the idea that that is the really fundamental part of philosophy and can be the basis of a critique of metaphysics. And this is very important for Wittgenstein. The third significant thing in principles follows on from the point that logic is concerned with the forms that propositions have. This next point is that you can't tell just by looking. For example, various philosophers like Leibniz had argued that propositions like A is larger than B that looked as if they expressed a relation between two things really had a quite different logical form. Russell defended the idea that they were genuinely relational. But what's important is the question itself. If there is a question what the real logical form is of some type of proposition, this reflects the idea that propositions have logical characteristics that may be hidden, and that philosophers can search out what their real form is. The fourth thing in Russell's book is his account of discovering the writings of the great German logician Gottlob Frege. Frege was then not well known, but Russell immediately recognized his significance and raves about his accomplishments in an appendix. So Wittgenstein, reading Russell's book, was directed to the works of Frege as developing logic in a very profound way. I mentioned that Principles of Mathematics conveys a wonderful sense of excitement at the recent discoveries in logic and their philosophical interest. I have in the handout, Wittgenstein's expression of this excitement, an expression of his own enthusiasm about the progress of logic. It's a little later. It's from a review that he wrote in 1913 of a book by a logician who was totally ignorant of the new logic. Wittgenstein writes that the author has not taken the slightest notice of the great work of the modern mathematical logicians, work which, Wittgenstein says, has brought about an advance in logic comparable only to that which made astronomy out of astrology and chemistry out of alchemy. So, Wittgenstein read Russell when he was 19, and 3 years later, he went to study with Russell. There is one other thing of Russell's that he read that's important, and that's Russell on philosophy and getting things clear. I have a quotation in the handout because the idea of clarification as what philosophy does turns out to be of enormous importance for Wittgenstein for all of his life. So this is a quotation from Russell on clarification. This is quotation L, and Russell is talking about clarifying the concepts of truth and falsity. In the case of a word such as truth, Russell says, we all feel that some fundamental concept of great philosophical importance is involved, though it is difficult to be clear as to what this concept is. What we wish to do is to detach this concept from the mass of irrelevancies in which, as we use it, it is normally embedded, and to bring clearly before the mind the abstract opposition on which our distinction of truth and falsity depends. In summary, then, Wittgenstein was getting from Russell a package of ideas, including the exhilarating progress of logic, the idea of logic as including the investigation of logical forms, and the idea of philosophy as pulling out from our confused ideas and beliefs a logical core and clarifying that logical core. Part three, this is about Wittgenstein and the spirit of modernity. If you read Wittgenstein's work and think about his life, you may be struck by his opposition to the spirit of 20th century civilization. This opposition is particularly clear in the preface for the book he started writing in 1930. Quotation M in the handout is from a draft of the preface, where he emphasized the difference between the spirit of his book, the book he's writing, and the spirit of the times. This spirit, the spirit of his book, is different from that, he says, of the vast stream of European and American civilization. The spirit of that civilization, which is expressed in the industry, architecture, and music of our time, is alien and unsympathisch to the author. Our civilization is characterized by the word progress. Progress is its form. Its activity is that of constructing an ever more complicated structure. I am not interested in putting up a building, but in having transparently before me the foundations of possible buildings. So my goal is not that of scientists, and my thoughts move differently from theirs. Wittgenstein distances himself there from the goals of science and also from what was going on in philosophy, the idea that philosophy could progress in the same way as science. I have a quotation from another draft of the preface. This is quotation N. Wittgenstein again makes a contrast between the spirit in which he writes and the spirit of contemporary civilization. He says that that spirit tries to grasp the world in its variety, while in his writing, he is trying to grasp the world at its center, in its essence. And I think this is interesting as bringing out that he sees trying to grasp the essence of the world as at the heart of his philosophy and as an opposition to the spirit of modernity. It's worth mentioning that the period during which Wittgenstein grew up, the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, saw enormous enthusiasm about progress. The narrative of the progress of civilization was widely propagated and widely accepted. So that's the background to Wittgenstein's own complex relationship to the idea of progress. It was in the air he breathed. Quotation K, where you get Wittgenstein's own use of ideas about progress in talking about logic that I read earlier, that comes from 1913, the year before the First World War, and a high point of confidence in progress, as yet unshaken by the war. But in these years, there was also a swell of criticism of the ideology of progress. And this is also very conspicuously present in Wittgenstein's Vienna before the war. I have included one more quote here from 1900 from the physicist Ludwig Boltzmann, quotation O. Boltzmann gives a picture of scientific progress. Again, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's really quite wonderful. He gives a picture of scientific progress as charging ahead like modern industrial production. And this is recognizably the picture that you can see adapted by philosophers, including Russell, as what they want to see in philosophy. And this is very alien to Wittgenstein. There's one last point I want to get to about Wittgenstein's relation to modernity. It's a point that's foreshadowed in quotation A, the first quotation, where Wittgenstein said that the way our problems get put rests on misunderstanding. This implies that in putting our problems a certain way, we are giving them their shape. We misshape them into being a particular kind of problem. That point comes out also in the quotation from Hertz, quotation D. Hertz thought that we may have an unclear desire to have something cleared up, but the desire gets expressed as a question about something we need to find out. So there again, there is the idea that we may give a shape to some kind of disquietude. We turn it into a question or problem of some apparently recognizable kind. And this idea that we may in various ways put things as problems of a particular kind, this is a point about the wider culture. In the background, there is the idea that we culturally have a stock of types of problem, a stock of ways to frame things as problems. And our modern conception of different sorts of problem goes with our ideas of how there can be progress in solving problems. An age of progress goes with the framing of our disquietudes and unclarities as the kind of problem where there are methods of moving forward, methods of charging ahead, for example, by division of labor. Our cultural understanding of progress and our ways of giving a shape to our problems are deeply linked on Wittgenstein's view. And this is connected closely with how alien he felt himself to be in relation to the scientifically minded philosophers of his time. It's not that they had different solutions to philosophical problems from Wittgenstein, but that their habits of thought were those of the dominant scientific culture. And those habits of thought included how they saw the whole business of philosophy, how problems were conceived and how you could make progress on them, building up a more and more complicated body of knowledge. Anyway, one part of Wittgenstein's response to contemporary philosophy is the idea that we are opaque to ourselves in our thinking about what we are trying to accomplish in philosophy. Well, part four is what next? Those three sketches of elements in Wittgenstein's thought are meant to raise two questions. How do they fit together or not fit together, and in what ways can we see them in his great works? This is what the rest of my lecture this evening is about. I want to show how the presence of these different elements in his thought meant that his first great work, the Tractatus, couldn't be what he wanted, and then I want to show how things changed in his later philosophy. I want to show something that Caleb Thompson has also argued for, namely that in the Tractatus, Wittgenstein violates his own intentions. I'll start by putting together one thing from part two and one from part three. In part two, I gave you a quotation from Russell, quotation L, about clarifying our logical concepts. The idea being that we have to purify off the irrelevancies. We have to get rid of the junk that makes it hard to see the pure logical form. I want to put this together with Wittgenstein's idea in quotation N that our civilization gets fixated on the superficial variety of the world and we don't get to what Wittgenstein wants to focus on, the essence of the world. Although that quotation comes from later than the Tractatus, in the Tractatus also, Wittgenstein lays great stress on the contrast between what belongs to the essence of language and what is merely accidental, all the superficial variety of languages and kinds of propositions. You can't see from all the variety what the underlying logic of language really is, what all languages have in common, what they have to have in common in order for them to be languages at all. What is it then for us genuinely to be saying that something or other is the case? We may say this is so or that is so, but what is the essence of saying that anything is so? If we purify off the irrelevancies and the variety here, what is left? This is in item P in the handout. I will tell you Wittgenstein's answer in a minute, but first look at quotation Q, which comes from much later, but it says that the question that Wittgenstein was asking was misconceived. As I said, this comes from later. It's at the heart of Wittgenstein's rethinking of his philosophy in Philosophical Investigations. There, he was talking about the questions he had been asking when he wrote the Tractatus, questions about the essence of language, of propositions, of thought. These questions, he says, this is in the Investigations, these questions see in the essence something that lies beneath the surface, something that lies within, which we see when we look into the thing, and which an analysis digs out. We ask, what is language? What is a proposition? And the answer to these questions is to be given once for all, and independently of any future experience. So there, Wittgenstein, 20 years after he wrote the Tractatus, took up a critical stance towards the question he had been asking. But look also at the first quotation on the handout from the Tractatus, and there Wittgenstein says that our questions lead us astray. I'm suggesting that there are two different attitudes in his early work. He is looking for what is essential in language. He is looking for what all propositions have to have in order to be propositions. But he is also aware that in asking these questions, we are putting as questions what is in some sense already known to us. Is Wittgenstein really able to handle the difficult balance of these two different attitudes in the Tractatus? But before I try to answer that, I'll give you a summary of Wittgenstein's answer to the question, well, what is the essence of saying that something is so? This is the answer in the Tractatus. Wittgenstein wanted to give a description of saying that something is so, a a description that will get at the essence and fit every single case. There is a summary, and it's terribly difficult to summarize. The Tractatus in about, sort of five lines. But anyway, there's a summary at R in the handout. The first feature in my list solves a problem that came up in the Russell essay that I quoted in L. This was the question, which Russell was asking, what the difference is between truth and falsity. A proposition can be true or it can be false. Maybe it is true if it's raining out and false if it's not raining out. So it looks as if, at least looks at first as if, there are two symmetrical relations that a proposition can have to the facts. One set of facts makes it true, another makes it false. But are truth and falsity actually symmetric? Are they equally good relations to the facts? So maybe we could go around just always using false propositions. Everyone would know they were false, and that would be fine. So you'd say, it's raining out, when that was false. That would be the convention, that you only use false propositions. You would use the sentence, it's raining out, to convey that it wasn't raining out. But then your sentence would be true if it wasn't raining out, if that's what you were trying to convey. You wouldn't be using a false sentence, but a true one. So the idea that we could always have as our convention that we used false sentences doesn't make sense. A proposition isn't equally related to what would make it true and what would make it false. If you use the sentence, it's raining, to convey that it's not raining, that's its sense, and it's true if it isn't raining. This is essential, and it goes with that point that if a proposition says that something is so, we can say the opposite. There is a proposition with opposite sense. And this understanding of sense is central in the way Wittgenstein lays out the essence of saying that something is so. The second point in my list is Wittgenstein's idea that although we use ordinary language when we express ourselves, what we say could be set out in a truly perspicuous language, where the logical characteristics of our propositions would be perfectly clear. The idea is that we can sometimes make ordinary propositions clearer by setting them out using a logical notation, and this had been enormously important in Russell's work. But then that idea, that fairly straightforward idea, that we can make our propositions somewhat clearer sometimes by using a logical notation, this leads to the idea that we can get down to the logical bottom, as it were, and get our propositions completely clear. And then we'll see the logical connections that are buried down in our ordinary sentences. We can bring out what is essential to propositionhood by restating our ordinary propositions and getting down to the logical bottom, and this would bring out what all propositions have in common. This logical notation would get us past the arbitrary conventional features of sentences to what belongs to them essentially. If a sentence says something is so, it has essential logical features that will show forth clearly in a logical notation. The third point in my list is that what justifies logical inferences is not some set of logical laws. If we have clearly in view how our propositions are constructed, we can see their logical relations as coming out of their internal structure. We will be able to see how logical inferences do not depend on anything more than what the propositions themselves are. The fourth point is that being clear what it is for a proposition to say that something is so will enable us also to see that logical propositions don't genuinely say anything is so. In the case of a tautology like, if it's raining, it's raining, you can see from its structure that it comes out to be true. And that's totally unlike a genuine proposition where you cannot ever just see from its structure whether it's true or false. And the final point is that if we have a clear logical way of expressing our propositions, we will be able to see where we have said something that is just a muddle. For example, by using some word in two different ways in the same context. Wittgenstein believed that this would enable us to see that metaphysical questions are as muddled as asking whether the good is more identical than the beautiful. Part five. So, what was the matter with this? It was a wonderful achievement, but it was profoundly flawed, as Wittgenstein himself came to see. I have three quotations at S in the handout, which all say that the book betrays its own intentions. And this is a very interesting criticism of a book. So the question is, how does the Tractatus sin against itself? Part five, this present part, gives you briefly three ways in which the book sins against its own intentions. First, right from the beginning, Wittgenstein had believed that in philosophy, we don't need to discover anything. We need to get clearer what is already in some sense available to us. And yet in the Tractatus, he held that at the logical bottom level of all language, there are propositions that we don't yet know, but could discover by logical analysis. There's a profound tension here, which he did not really recognize until he came back to philosophy in 1929. The second way the Tractatus goes against Wittgenstein's own intentions is that Wittgenstein always held, in his early philosophy and later, that to clear up philosophical misunderstandings, we don't need any kind of theory. We need a clear presentation of the way words are used. In the Tractatus, he thought of this as a matter of presenting what is common to all the uses of an expression. And in particular, you could present what is common to all propositions, what propositions as such all share. But then the problem is, well, what is it that propositions all share? How is it that they carry out their logical function? And this indeed led Wittgenstein to a kind of theory of propositionhood, although he didn't see that that was what he was doing. He thought he could present what propositions all shared, what was essential to them, so that you could indeed then see this logical feature in them. You could see it in your own thought and language. And this would make clear how propositions achieve what they achieve, how they say that something is so. He didn't see that he was putting forward a theory. It was only much later that he saw how you can fail to realize that you are putting forward a theory. So that's a second kind of problem in the Tractatus. Now the third one. For Wittgenstein, the contrast between science and philosophy was always important. And this, then, is the way you get to the third way the Tractatus sins against its own nature, its own better nature. Philosophy, he had said in 1913, is purely descriptive. And he meant that as a contrast with science, which has explanatory aims. In the 1930s, when he thought back about the Tractatus, he could see how far he had strayed from that ideal. He could see how far he had been actually engaged in explanation. For example, he could see that his account of how propositions are constructed had provided a kind of explanation of logic. When he had first said that philosophy was descriptive and not explanatory, he hadn't really understood the force of that idea. And he had unwittingly, in his early work, gone in for a lot of explanation. A great deal of what he had thought of in the Tractatus as clarification had actually, I would say, veered over into explanation. These tensions in the Tractatus were invisible to Wittgenstein when he wrote the book. He didn't see that he wasn't counting his discoveries as discoveries. He didn't see his theorizing as theorizing, and he didn't recognize how deeply his picture of digging down to the bottom logical level expressed the desire for explanation. Part six. How did this happen? What was Wittgenstein's diagnosis? There are two important elements in Wittgenstein's later diagnosis of what had gone wrong. Plus, there is a pivotal idea that points the way forward to his later work. The two elements in Wittgenstein's diagnosis are that he had been hung up on a confused sort of question, and that he had a confused idea of where we need to look in order to solve our philosophical problems. So the first thing is the confused question. This is the question, how do propositions manage to express that something or other is the case? How do they do it? How does it work? Wittgenstein later spoke about how we get drawn into such questions. We are seduced into thinking that something quite remarkable is achieved by propositions. We misunderstand the fact that when we say that something is so, our words are indeed about reality. They are in contact with the world, with how things are. But then we begin to think that we need an explanation. How does this work? How is it that our words manage to get in touch with reality? It looks like an achievement. The second thing in Wittgenstein's diagnosis, apart from the confused question about how propositions achieve what they achieve, the second thing is the idea about where we need to look in order to solve our problem. We saw this already at quotation L from Russell, the idea that logical features of our language are difficult to see because in our ordinary language there are all these irrelevancies in which the logical concepts are embedded. So the idea was, and you're seeing this already in that quotation from Russell, that in philosophy we need to purify off the irrelevancies, almost like purifying off impurities in chemistry. The Russell-Wittgenstein picture is that at the surface level of language, there's a huge amount of variety, so the logically essential features don't stand out. And you can also see in quotation N how Wittgenstein, and this is as late as 1930, how Wittgenstein thinks about the importance of getting past the variety to the logical essence underneath. This idea that the level at which there is variety is philosophically irrelevant, this is an enormously important part of what Wittgenstein later came to think had been wrong in his earlier thinking. In his old way of thinking, there had been a kind of contempt for particular cases, that's his phrase, a contempt for particular cases, except so far as they provided you with a path to getting past them to the underlying essence. The pivotal idea in Wittgenstein's diagnosis is that his mind had been, as it were, fixated so that the possibility of thinking in some different way couldn't even appear to him. And what he had been fixated on was the idea of a proposition. Not our ordinary idea of ordinary sentences, but a super sort of logical conception of what a proposition was. So it wasn't anything you could find out about by looking at our ordinary life with ordinary sentences. Given the hold that this idea had on his mind, it had been totally invisible to him that there could be any other approach than the one he was taking. In his later philosophy, Wittgenstein tries to break the hold of that state of mind. He thinks we need to be enabled to see as philosophically relevant the familiar ordinary aspects of things. The state of mind in which we're fixated on the logical notion of a proposition is precisely one in which we can't see the ordinary familiar aspects as philosophically relevant. They remain invisible. At quotation V, there is one of the central points, I think, in Wittgenstein's later thought. He says, the aspects of things which are most important for us in philosophy are ones we just don't see because they are so obvious and familiar and simple. We can't take in the significance of what is striking and central in the ways we actually live with our language and our concepts. We think we have to look past these things to get at what really has logical significance. We think we have to dig. And Wittgenstein's idea was that a kind of transformation in us is necessary so that we can take in what is in front of our noses as actually relevant to philosophical problems. What is in front of our noses, our everyday life with words, is exactly what he had thought you had to get past to get to the essence, to get to what was genuinely in common to all propositions. Individual particular cases in all their variety could be relevant in philosophy as he saw it, only so far as they might disclose something of what lay below the level of variety. The transformation that he came to think of as necessary is one that keeps in view what we want in pursuing a philosophical question, but radically shifts us in what we can come to see as relevant, including what we had taken to be logically irrelevant because we had been in search of the hidden essence. But now we should note that this new approach was going to affect Wittgenstein's ideas about culture, not just about philosophy. In 1930, when he spoke of how deeply unsympathetic he found the spirit of modernity, he used the metaphor of wanting to have transparently before him the foundations of possible buildings. He was not interested in putting up this or that new building. He wanted, that is, to see down into what was at the center of things, not the variety that you can see on the surface. That metaphor expressed his distance from his contemporaries and their conception of progress. What then should we say about his later criticism of his early thought? Is he suddenly more in tune with modernity, or does he still see himself as not in tune with contemporary civilization, but with a changed understanding of why? I will be arguing for the second alternative in the final section, which comes next. So, part seven on later Wittgenstein. Item W in the handout has three quotations. The first from Philosophical Investigations, where Wittgenstein describes his old mindset, the idea of logic as seeing down into the essential nature of things. Then I have one quotation from the Tractatus and one from Russell, expressing exactly that view of philosophy. He had been in the grip of the idea of philosophy as a kind of superscience, dealing with the essence of the world and the essence of language. Despite his insistence that philosophy was totally distinct from the sciences, I think you can argue that a quasi-scientific conception had been at the heart of his early philosophy and his early ideas about his relation to contemporary culture. In part three, when I was laying out how Wittgenstein felt distanced from scientific-minded philosophers, I said that their habits of thought were those of the dominant scientific culture. But he came to recognize how hard it is to see things in a different way, and he saw, too, how his understanding of logic as a kind of superscience also could be taken to reflect his own embeddedness in the culture. And this then leads to what I think is a very significant feature of his later work, and especially probably the most famous part of it, his discussions of following a rule. These discussions are set out in dialogue with himself, with the ways we think about our own rationality, about our own minds. We want to see down to the real grounds of our rationality, and Wittgenstein portrays this very vividly because he felt its draw on him so deeply. We are dazzled by the image of there being something down deeper that would explain what is involved in our rationality. And we don't see that what is involved in our rationality is before our eyes in the ways we actually live and think. This later understanding of philosophy and its difficulty reshapes Wittgenstein's understanding of contemporary culture. He no longer sees the difference between the spirit of his thinking and that of his time in the way he set it out in the 1930 preface in quotations M and N. There he had said that he is concerned not with the variety on the surface of things, but with the essence of the world. And that's now no longer how he would put it. But I can't give you any quotation to do for you in connection with his later thinking what quotations M and N give of his earlier response to 20th century civilization. There are various things one could point to that express how he saw his distance from the wider culture, but I will here just mention how his relation to contemporary philosophy is expressive of his wider cultural concerns. In part three, I mentioned Wittgenstein's distance from the scientific-minded philosophers who were his contemporaries, whose conception of philosophical problems was very like that of scientific problems, where you have various theories, and the problems themselves are shaped so that there is the possibility of making progress stepwise on them. There's an underlying conception here of cognitive gain, of what counts as something being someone's being in a cognitively better position. And this is ultimately a scientistic conception. Wittgenstein's idea of philosophy as responding to disquietudes of thought is at its heart opposed to the scientistic conception of philosophical problems and to the wider cultural understanding of knowledge and expertise. For Wittgenstein, what makes philosophy hard is ultimately our own resistance to re-seeing things. Our questions insistently seem to demand a deeper theorization of the facts. As you can see, for example, if you learned about the philosophy of color in Descartes or Locke or Hume, and if you now take a look at the incredible proliferation of philosophical theorizing of color. Is it or isn't it part of the real world? Are you going to be a realist about color or an eliminativist or a fictionalist or what? Anyway, the idea that it is possible for there to be, in response to all that, a presentation of the complex life we have with color thinking, a presentation that could undo the sense we have of philosophical puzzlement here, and that would genuinely satisfy our original sense of there being something we didn't understand about what color really is. The idea that this puzzlement can be undone, disentangled, comes up against our whole cultural way of thinking of knowledge and progress. I haven't tried to give some general account of how philosophical problems are connected with contemporary modes of thought, and I can't. After all, one of Wittgenstein's favorite examples of philosophical problems is Augustine's difficulties about time, and Augustine's culture was obviously deeply different from ours. And even within our culture, philosophical problems are various and don't all reflect some single underlying sickness of our times. But I have tried to give you some sense of how Wittgenstein wanted to problematize for us our habits of thought and the role in them of our ideas about solving problems, getting answers, and making progress. That's it.